Well. Welcome back to a new episode of Lo-Fi Lit. This is a podcast hosted by me, your host, Tyler Byrne out of Tulsa, Oklahoma. I've been a fan, a spectator, the literary spaces, the online literary space, poets, literary mags, for many years, about 15 years now, from Shabby Doll House, Moo Moo House, Fiddleback, Pimbildy Boz, Dark Fucking Wizards, Warlocks, Deathical, HTML Giant, Glimmer Train, Glitter House, whatever, iShot.net, Hobart, Barrel Mag, all those fun places. Just been reading and taking everything in. Well, thought it was time I started my own magazine. Yep, that's right. There is a magazine based off this podcast. It features writers, poets, essays. Go to lofimag.com. Go check it out. Recently published Jennifer Espinosa, a poet who's been published by Boost House, Civil Coping Mechanisms, and Big Lux. Big Lux. It's a fantastic interview, as always, as most of my interviews are. Yeah, there we go. Let's get to the interview. You know me. I don't like introductions. I just want to get straight to the thing. Yeah, go check out lofimag.com. We got ZH Gill. We got Claire Hopple. We got Tyler Dempsey. We got Autumn Christian. They're nice enough to lend me a story. It's a very long story. About a robot and a virus. About relationships. It's a lie. It's a science fiction literary tale. But that's enough for now. Got some other pieces too. I have some episodes that I've already recorded, and I apologize to those guests, but I feel like I wanted to jump ahead since I just recorded this tonight. I'm going to go ahead and put this out. Very minimal editing. No, I didn't really edit this. Just going to throw it up there. Because you know what? Jennifer's poetry is already on the site. I want to try and put out episodes with people who are on the magazine and put up the podcast when they get published. So that is the reason for doing that. Otherwise, I would, you know, be putting out someone's, it'd be like a couple weeks before this went out. And by that time frame, it doesn't make sense. So I'm trying to, like, you know, you see what the dilemma is and why I'm solving it by putting this out right now. All right. My name's Tyler Byrne. This is Lo-Fi Lit, the podcast. Now there is a magazine. I was gonna see if you wanted to read the poem that you published.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was thinking that earlier too. I'm glad you thought of that. Okay, so do I just
start
reading it? Okay. This is called Form. I don't need a job. I need money. Nobody understands the difference anymore. I went hungry as a child, my shoes worn down to holes through which the earth became my mother. I don't need a partner. I need love. I don't need freedom. I need room. A room. Small room with walls to beat and beat and beat and beat against my working body until I am free.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for publishing it.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for sending me poems. It's like incredible.
I mean, what a concept to send somebody poems and then have those poems published. Like, it's just like, wow, this is, who knew it was that easy?
Yeah. I wanted to ask, like, do you think that, or do you feel like that you've made it?
Wow. We're starting off with the big questions. I love that. No, that's a really, really good question. I think I go back and forth on that all of the time in terms of thinking about, like, what does it mean to make it? I feel like in a lot of ways, I have accomplished something that I set out to do, maybe not even consciously, but which was to have a voice and to be able to articulate myself in a way that makes sense to me and also communicates some kind of truth and also beauty and also transcendence. I think those are things we all want in a way, but for me, that avenue was through writing, and it was something I have been doing my whole life and have always been interested in. And so in terms of thinking about, like, have I made it? I guess the metrics for that have to do with, like, how these experiences have shaped me personally and my relationship to art, to other people, to myself. And so, yeah, I think that the things I've been able to do as a writer, as a poet, have allowed me to arrive at that place, or a version of that place, maybe. It's like always shifting and changing. And I think my metrics for what counts as, like, making it will always be in flux. But yeah, like, for instance, last night I was watching the Jennifer Garner movie, 13 Going on 30. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, I'm sure everybody knows the premise, but it's basically this 13-year-old girl who wishes that she was 30, 30, flirty and thriving. And she wakes up as a 30-year-old and she's like, oh my God, what the fuck, where am I? And it's like this really great metaphor for when you have, like, those parts of yourself, like the quote unquote inner child or whatever. And those days when you kind of wake up and you're like, how did I get here? What? And you feel like that kid again and all of the confusion. And so for me, making it feels like if I wake up and I'm that, like, child version of myself, can I be proud of, like, what's around me? And I feel like, yeah, finally I am in that place.
I wanted to ask, because, like, based off, like, the poem, like, do you feel like, do you have time to, like, write poetry, like, sit down and, like, focus on poetry? Like, if you, yeah. I was looking at your publications, like, Boost House, Civil Coping Mechanisms, Big Lux. If you look back at the place where you started, like, with Boost House, and you look back at that time, like, do you feel like you won't have more freedom and more abilities to sit and write poetry than work?
Probably less time and freedom.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. Well, I was working, and it's like a blessing and a curse in a way, because now that I'm unemployed, I have a lot of time to write, and I wrote all those poems. Well, actually, a couple of those poems I wrote, like, very recently that I sent you, and then a couple of them were a little bit older, from, like, the last year or two. But yeah, up until becoming unemployed 2 days before Christmas, I
what? And
it was by choice. It was I had to. I was leaving a marriage and moving and the job itself. There was a lot about the situation where it was like, okay, I need to make some changes. So yeah, I left that job, packed all my things up, moved to LA, having a great time. But there's that double-edged sword of, like, okay, now I have time to write, but also, you know, the clock is ticking. Got to make money, got to support yourself, all of those things. So I feel like when I was first getting published, I was a college dropout. I was basically spending all of my time in my grandparents' garage smoking cigarettes and posting on Tumblr, as one does, and just dealing with, like, extreme, like, anxiety and panic attacks and mental and physical health symptoms that were really confounding to me at the time. And it took a lot of years to work through. But I was basically disabled and couldn't really work or function. All I could do was smoke cigarettes and read and write poetry. So again, it's that double-edged thing of, like, in order to be in that position, there are other things that sometimes have to fall to the side, like having a normal life. That is not to say you can't have a life balanced between art and, like, survival. But for me, that was always a struggle. So, yeah, I had a lot more time to write poetry back then. And now I have more time to like live my life and be a person and like be in the world. And so for me, that's like a good trade-off. I'm happy to be maybe like, it's like sometimes when you're closer to the knife's edge, you can access this form of transcendence in a certain way. And then when you step back and you're living a more stable, safe life, sometimes you forget how to access that same transcendence. And it's like transcendence isn't everything. I'm not saying that you have to be in pain to create beautiful art. In fact, I think that ideally that would not be the case. But when you learn to create art under certain conditions and then your conditions change, it changes your relationship to your creative practice.
Have you thought about doing like online teaching, online workshops to make money?
Oh yeah, I did that a lot over the past few years with my ex. We did these like online workshops, and you know, it was a great community building experience, and I really loved the students that we worked with. But I wouldn't say it's like the best money making venture. So it's the kind of thing I might do if I'm like, if I need like cigarette money or something like that. Okay. Yeah.
Are there people like out in California though that you can reach out to and like?
Yeah, I've thought about reaching out to some maybe like local venues that I've worked with before and seeing if like I could host an in-person kind of workshop experience. I think that would probably draw more people in, and just like I think people are kind of longing for like the intimacy of those spaces for sure.
Mm-hmm. Do you do lectures and stuff?
Yeah. So. Before I had my day job for the past couple of years, my main job was a creative writing professor. And I still do that from time to time, like adjunct at various places. I just taught a course online in a grad program to poetry students, and that was cool. And I'm hoping this fall to land somewhere. So I'm looking around at like local universities and yeah, I love teaching.
How do you, what do you love about teaching?
That's a great question. I feel like I'm inhabiting or accessing a part of myself that I really enjoy and really like a person that I really I get to be that person when I'm teaching. And I just enjoy like working with other writers and trying to understand what they're setting out to do with their work, and then also helping them understand on a deeper level, maybe like what they're setting out to do, and then helping them like get there and accomplish it. Like, I love that it's different with every student. I really like working closely and like mentoring students and getting to know, what their projects are, what they're interested in. And again, just like helping them get to that place. That feels really good.
When you were back in your grandparents' basement, like smoking cigarettes, at what point had you found poetry that was an outlet for you?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I started writing poetry and kind of getting into poetry like when I was in high school, I would say. This was like early 2000s, live journal era. Definitely had a live journal. Definitely had a MySpace blog where I was just posting poems every day. And it was just at that time a way of coping with whatever feelings I was dealing with that day, whether it be like horrible trauma or like having my heart broken by a crush, whatever it was, I would turn it into poetry just as like a coping mechanism. And I would just, yeah, put it on my live journal, put it on my MySpace, and like nobody cared for a long time. And then eventually some people would be like, oh, that's really cool, or you should keep doing this. And it just became kind of a regular practice for me.
Is that when you, what was the first like online community that you found?
First online community. I'm going to, again, both with the live journal reference and this, I'm really aging myself. It was the Saddle Creek web board. I don't know if anybody knows what that is.
I don't.
But it's the record label Saddle Creek that was really popular in like the 2000s, like Bright Eyes, Rilo Kiley, all those guys. And they had a message board. Message boards were like really popular at that time. This was like 2003, 2004. And so I registered for the Saddle Creek message board, which was apparently where all the cool, like hipster, like kind of indie rock people of that period were hanging out. And yeah, I just like spent a lot of time there getting bullied by older people who were like,
what the fuck?
I mean, no, that's just the internet culture.
Yeah.
It was very like that. It was like younger Gen X people. And then like 15-year-old millennials getting like bullied.
So when do you find Tumblr and find like alt-lit?
Oh yeah, totally. So I got on Tumblr like 2009, didn't know anything about it. Didn't like follow anybody. I was going through this really crazy time period where I was snorting Adderall and staying up all night and reading beat poetry and just like writing insane screeds and as one does. And I was like, I have to do something with this. And I'd heard about Tumblr. I didn't really know what it was. I just like made an account and started posting poems and not really doing anything with it. And then again, it was like with MySpace or LiveJournal, it was like nothing at first. And then suddenly a few people would see it and be like, oh, I really like this, or this is cool. And I would start to see random like comments showing up on my Tumblr, and then like people would follow me. And I was like, I don't really know what this is, but I'm just going to keep going with it. And so my first poetry community was on Tumblr. And yeah, wow, this is like really taking me back. Memory holds so much of this. But there was like a poetry hashtag on Tumblr. And so they had like different hashtags on Tumblr that were like communities, and you could click on it and they would have like editors for those hashtags who are kind of, I don't know how they were selected, but they would be chosen and then they would select pieces to highlight within that like interest. And so in the poetry group, everybody was constantly kind of fighting to have like their poem featured in the poetry hashtag. And you'd start to see people writing in specific ways or towards certain things and kind of trying to like do what they thought might be selected by whoever was the editor. And so that was really interesting. It was like a proto MFA experience in that sense, of like seeing the kind of competitive side of it. And yeah, again, a really formative experience.
Were there any writers at that time that really hit you when you read their poetry?
Oh gosh, yeah, again, the memory hole is deep. I'm also nursing a hangover, so my brain is not fully there, but I'm gonna try to remember. Like Tumblr people that I was really, I'm not remembering names right now because again, a lot of these people, like I never, you know, we all go in different directions. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely, there are still people that I'm like mutuals with on like social media from that time period, but I wouldn't say I'm like close with anybody from that time period.
Yeah. What about like classic poetry? Did you read?
Oh, yeah. No, I always say like I try to read more contemporary poetry. I don't always live up to that standard that I've set for myself. I usually just always fall back on Emily Dickinson, Rilke. Those two are definitely like huge for me. And then David Berman's Book of Poetry is also really important to me. I feel like those are the three poets I kind of carry around with me at all times and always return back to and like feel like I wouldn't exist in some way, or my voice wouldn't exist in some ways without those people.
Now I'm going to bring up a controversial name, and if you don't want to talk about this, that's okay.
Okay.
So Rogan Buck.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
How did Rogan Buck find you, and what was it like interacting with the Boost House people?
Yeah, I found out about him through Tumblr, and kind of like as all that was becoming a thing in the early 2010s. And I'm trying to remember how it happened. Okay, yeah, that's right. I was part of this reading that this was like pre-Zoom. I forget what the name of the platform was, but there was this platform where you could kind of host these like gatherings online, similar to what we do with Zoom now. And somebody put together a reading, and it was like kind of alt-lit affiliated people. And then I ended up somehow getting my way, you know, grifting my way into the group. I felt like such an outsider, but it was really cool because these were people I was like, whose writing I was reading and starting to, yeah, like influence me and things like that. And so it was really interesting. And I guess Steve was there or like at one of the readings and saw, and then reached out and asked if I wanted to have a poem in like this anthology he was putting together. And then from there, that's how I ended up getting my first chapbook published with Boost House.
So did you have positive interactions mostly?
I mean, it was mostly over email and it was mostly very formal. And then we met in person like twice. And I don't, people always do that thing when like you find out horrible things about someone where they're like, I always had a feeling or I always knew. And it's like, that's such bullshit. You could say that about anybody. Everybody has like weird shit that you could then like retroactively turn around and point to and be like, oh, I always, so I don't want to do that. But I will say I did not come away from those interactions feeling like warm towards that person. I'll leave it at that.
The live readings that you went to online, do you know, do you know Walter Mackey?
I know the name.
Okay. I know they did some of those. I was just wondering if you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it could have been. It very well could have been. Again, this was like so long ago. Yeah. And also at the time when it was happening, I like didn't let myself feel that it was real because it was so exciting in a way that I couldn't like handle it. So I just kind of like turned off that part of my brain and let myself move along. And so I feel like in a lot of ways, when I think back to those years that I was starting to get published and getting attention for my work, I almost have to retroactively like get enjoyment out of that because at the time I didn't let myself really feel it.
Yeah. And it was such a movement. It would be like it had never really happened before or since, just like the internet and that rise of creative writing and the youth movement. It's impossible to even recognize if you're in the moment. Did you have any people you could like confide in at that time?
I guess kind of. But I always felt like I was kind of like off in my own corner. And I've always felt that way, like with any community I've been a part of for like most of my life. I feel like I've always kind of had like one foot in the door, one foot out, or kind of like standing on the outside looking in, like that kind of feeling. And a lot of that is self-imposed. Just with like my anxiety and trust issues and difficulties with like relating to people or like existing socially, which has gotten a lot better, but like especially when I was younger, I just like didn't really know how to be a person. So I've always just kind of, like I said, like one foot in the door, one foot out.
I totally understand like that kind of insecure feeling, like what am I, who am I?
Yeah,
like that identity thing. Yeah,
exactly. And also not wanting to become subsumed by a scene or like movement in a way that like dampens your own voice.
Yeah. How do you maintain that? How do you maintain your originality?
That's a really good question. In my experience, I've had to fight for it in some ways. I'm thinking like being in the MFA, which I did later on, after I'd already published two books. And then I'm also thinking about, like, once my work did start getting that attention, especially like in the mid 2010s, and a lot of like institutions and outlets were kind of like trying to put off the appearance of being like woke or whatever. And so there were certain ways that I feel like my work and my image were used that like I either didn't really consent to or didn't enjoy, and then later realized like I wasn't actually worth anything to those institutions. It was all just like, you know, they follow the tide, they follow the trends, they do what they do, and you just watch from a distance as they shamelessly move along with the culture, whichever direction it's going, whichever way the pendulum is swinging. So that was like a real eye-opening experience in terms of like, ooh, okay, I can't let my voice be caught up in whatever is happening institutionally or in the culture. I can't be writing in reaction to what's happening. Like, of course, we all exist within the conditions we're in and we're writing like from that place, but I wanted more, I think. And so that was a huge part of like a struggle for me over the past maybe like 6 years, where I felt like I didn't know like what my voice was anymore. I didn't know like what my place was in like the writing world or in the world in general. And there were so many times where I just thought about just stopping and not doing it anymore.
Oh, for real? What, did you have any plans on what you would do if you stopped writing?
Probably just focus on teaching, or I didn't really think about it. I just felt like this kind of like sick feeling in my gut around like the literary world for a really long time.
When, like in the, yeah, that makes sense. I think a lot of people did. I mean, a lot of people left.
Yeah. I don't blame them.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like right now there's kind of a little rise going on, but I feel like definitely. there's gonna be a fall off at some something's gonna happen. There's gonna be a fall off again.
Yeah,
and you just gotta stick it out. And like, you know, everyone's gonna be alone again at some point. I think I get maybe.
Yeah, no, you're so right. And once you've seen that rise and fall happen enough times, you can kind of just like relax and be like, okay, I can just do my thing. It'll either come back to me or it won't. Like, who cares? Like, So I think, yeah, that there's a lot of wisdom in what you said there about that.
I think that's why I've stuck or like clinged on to Shabby Dollhouse, because somehow those people, they seem to stick it out and they just stick through the arts and writing and all that stuff.
Yeah, getting a I don't even remember what poem it was because it was so long ago, but getting a poem published with them was like a dream come true for me. I remember I had sent them a piece early on and it had been rejected for a very good reason. It was not a good poem. I'm glad they didn't publish that first piece I sent. Thank you guys. And then I ended up getting a piece published. And yeah, it was like, that was one of those moments where I was like, I've made it.
Yeah. They were a big, big deal even back then.
Yeah.
Did you ever consider starting your own magazine, or did you ever work on a magazine?
I've thought about starting my own magazine. I've like worked for, or I've done some like editing work for like a couple of startup, or like, you know, kind of like just getting their feet off the ground kind of places. And I found it was kind of a grueling experience, especially when you're like not getting paid. And
oh yeah,
it was a lot. So I feel like people, I don't know. It depends on how you go about it. Like I think there are ways to do it in a minimal way where you can like not overwhelm yourself, but like, okay, for instance, with the magazine you just started, like how has that been for you? Do you feel like it's been easy, or has it been like, is there more that goes into it than you imagined?
Yeah, I'm just winging it and pretending like it's a magazine. And I'm just
you're
like,
doing great. You're doing amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I'm getting a lot of attention because of your repost. So thank you.
Oh yeah, of course. I'm so happy to. I mean, in a lot of ways, getting published with Lo-Fi was like, I felt like a weight was lifted, or like I broke through some kind of barrier that I'd had up for a while related to those things I was sharing earlier about like publishing in the literary world and just like not trusting outlets in terms of like why they wanted me or if they wanted me or like what this poetry meant to them. And just, yeah, there's a lot that has gone into it. That has kind of like made me feel like just not wanting to submit my work anywhere. And so I've mostly been just like sharing it online, sharing it on Instagram, kind of going back to like how I started, because for me, like poetry is like such a pure practice and art form. Like I'll be happy to sell out and write a memoir or whatever eventually. Mm-hmm. And I'll get my money that way. But poetry, that's like, it's sacred to me. So sorry, what was your original question?
I want to know like what magazines specifically. Can you name? Do you not want to name any names?
In terms of
magazines that like wronged you or you felt wrong?
Well, I mean, nobody wronged me. I don't mean to make it sound dramatic. It's not that anybody like did anything blatantly, whatever. It's just more so that like identity politics thing of everybody shows up at your door because it's trendy to support the trannies or whatever. And now we all hate the trannies, so they stop showing up at your door. And that's what I meant by kind of like the cultural swing, like following the pendulum, all of that. And so for me, I just like was exhausted by the idea of engaging in that ecosystem. Kind of thinking about the undercurrent and like kind of like that what's happening in the psychic plane beyond like what we're actually seeing. The vibes were just off and wrong and like bad. And yeah, I just don't have any interest as a poet in being like institutionally accepted or recognized. Again, happy to do that for like fiction or a memoir so I can make some money here. But again, poetry is sacred to me. And so it's like, why would I, like, what would even be the benefit of allowing my poetry, my voice, whatever, to be used in ways I don't agree with, when, like, what are you going to get out of that? Like, poetry doesn't sell in the same way that other things do. It's not like a moneymaker. So what are you selling out for if you're a poet? Like, it just didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I thought there'd be, I don't know, super successful poets, but really there are none. Like,
there's
really
like doesn't... two. Yeah.
Yeah. Are there other contemporary writers that also feel this way?
I'm sure there are. I don't know how willing everybody is to like talk about it or articulate it. And I think also it's hard to articulate. I'm struggling to articulate it. I don't even really know how to make sense of it. It's just like a feeling. But I get the sense that, yeah, there probably are a lot of people that feel that. I mean, I think everybody feels constrained by identity. You see all these pieces lately about like the male writer and the crisis there. And it's like, well, we're all in crisis, actually.
Yeah.
For various reasons that intersect and align and oppose in various ways. And it's like, yeah, life is hard and identity always comes into play.
Has anyone like, have any trans women ever like reached out to you and said a poem, like help them or?
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, those were the, when it goes back to that question of like thinking about not writing poetry anymore or thinking about quitting, like that was probably like those experiences were among some of the most important experiences in helping me feel like, okay, I can keep doing this. I want to keep doing this. Even if I can't do it for myself right now, like at least I can have some positive effect on the world.
Mm-hmm. The thing that I struggled with the magazine for the longest of like creating one was like, I specifically wanted to create a gay, like men's magazine or just a gay magazine.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know that many gay people that are creatively writing in, I guess, the alt-lit spaces. And it's like, you have to seek out, like, you have to deliberately seek it out and put mm-hmm. energy and time again and again and again to carve that out. And I was already in, like, the Shabby Doll. It's like, I'll just create a magazine and then publish, like, who I want. And if that comes, that'll come, I guess.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a great ethos. And I mean, it shows in the quality of the work on your website, and like the curation of that is very apparent, I think, to anybody who's looking at it. Everything from the design, the font choices, mm-hmm. like all of it just feels very considered and yeah, just like aligned in a really cool way.
But like, I struggle with like, I don't know, like, because I live in Tulsa. I don't like live in New York, or I don't live in California. So finding like there's no gay community like here.
Girl. Then,
yeah.
No, I feel you. I just moved to LA a few weeks ago, and this is my first time ever living in a big city. My entire life I've lived in like mid-sized to small towns, suburbs, rural, like, mm-hmm. so I've never really had access to like IRL gay community or trans community.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever go like, oh, I should have like a group of like gay friends? Like some days I get really like into that, but then the next day I'm like, oh, fuck it. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing.
My feeling on that is like, yes, it's important to have people in your life that you can understand and relate to in those ways. But I think it has to happen organically. And in my experience, like when people try to build community, and when I say community, I'm talking about like friendship community, like obviously mutual support and aid, like that is a given. But in terms of like a friend group, if you're just selecting a friend group based on like your identity or whatever, it's not always going to work out because that's one element of like a trillion that make you who you are.
Yeah, that's so true. I wanted to ask, did you have a good experience with Big Lux?
Oh yeah, Big Lux is great. Love Big Lux. Yeah, nothing but good things.
Can you talk about your experience with them?
It was just very easy. I mean, it reminded me of like what it was like when I sent you those poems. It was very just like no nonsense, like, all right, cool, we're doing this and this is how it's going to look. And just very easy, just mm-hmm. very easy to work with, very kind.
At that time in your life, were you struggling at any point or was it easier? I don't know.
In terms of?
Like your life, I guess, had it gotten easier?
Oh, yeah. I see what you're saying. I mean, yeah, like life is like peaks and valleys always. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say during that time, that was like a little bit before I was getting ready to join the MFA. And I had just finished, I went back to school, finished my undergrad. So yeah, I was definitely feeling like things were on the up and up mm-hmm. during that time for sure.
At what point do you feel confident in writing poetry?
Ask me again in 10 years. No, I'm just kidding. I don't know. Like, confident. Yeah. I don't know if confidence comes into play for me with poetry. It's more like faith, because I feel like when I'm writing poetry, it's almost like this religious experience, and it feels like I'm channeling something, and I'm just like this like medium that's there to translate it. And so because of that, like, that prevents ego from getting too involved in the process, I think. And so like confidence doesn't even come into play, because it's more like, okay, these words just came out of me. This feels right. Like, when you know, you know. Or this doesn't feel quite right. Maybe I'll set this aside and look at it later, or see if something else comes out. But yeah, I guess the question of confidence, that maybe used to come into play when I was a younger poet and was more concerned with like looking around at what other people were doing and comparing myself to other poets. But after having been through all of these things that I've shared with you, I've like come to this place of just realizing, like, I just have to be with myself in that sense when it comes to the poetry. And I have to trust that this thing that I've had of receiving words or images or feelings that I then, you know, transmute into poetry has been something that's been with me for a lot of my life. And it's an important part of me.
Mm-hmm. So you had published 2 books before you went into the MFA. What was the decision to go into the MFA?
Mostly just because to have something to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the honest answer. I felt like I had to. I felt like I was on this track, on this like path. And everyone's like, you know, get an MFA. And I went in knowing, you know, I'd heard the critiques of MFAs. I'd read all the critiques. I'd heard the stories of people who had had difficult times in their MFA. I will say I don't regret doing the MFA. There was good and bad that came out of it, for sure, like anything else. And just like with any community of people who are competing for like a very small pool of resources, it definitely, yeah, creates interesting dynamics. But it was a good learning experience. The MFA was a really good learning experience for me, because I got to, first of all, expand my knowledge of like this thing that I was doing. And like educate myself more, and then getting time to write. I joined a fully funded program, so I was able to get a stipend and teach and do all of that. I always tell people, like, don't get an MFA unless it's fully funded or you're like a trust fund kid. like, be funded in some way, shape, or form. Don't pay out of pocket for an MFA. But it was a really good learning experience. I got exposed to a lot of new things. I definitely, yeah, expanded the range of like my voice and my craft. I learned a lot about poetic forms from my mentor, Katie Ford, who is amazing. She's so good. Like, please read her work, support her. She's amazing. She really got me interested in poetic forms, and kind of like helped me understand the reasoning for why certain forms might be used in a certain way, or like what it means to tap into this like existing inherited structures, and also like how you can make them your own. And just like, yeah, before that I was pure free verse, and almost as like an ethos, which is silly in retrospect, but I think it was just a stubborn unwillingness to do the hard work of learning about something outside of my knowledge or whatever. But so yeah, learning about craft from Katie Ford was amazing, and totally informed what would become my most recent poetry collection. Most of that was written in the MFA. And so yeah, that book came out of the MFA. That was really cool too. And then the other thing was getting to see firsthand what it's like and I don't know any other way to say this, so I'm just going to say it, but what it's like to witness people like cynically using identity politics as a tool of competition within an ecosystem of people competing for a very small pool of resources. And, you know, it's the kind of thing you hear about, but like, I had spent so much time online that I was like, oh yeah, right. Like, that's not a thing. But then I got to the MFA and I was like, oh yeah, maybe some of those critics are right. Maybe some of those critics of identity politics have a point. And so definitely like, like, I was already kind of critical of like the liberalization of like these radical ideas or whatever that we saw happening, the Tumblr to mainstream pipeline, but seeing it in person play out was like crazy, I will say, and definitely like negatively polarized me away from a lot of that.
Did it keep you from writing about subjects that you would have?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yeah, I think I got really like, I think I tried to be a little more, I don't know, this isn't the right word, like not subversive, but like I tried to play around with that aspect of my work, especially because I go into workshop and yeah, it was workshop was really interesting. People, I think, were afraid to, like, everybody brought in poems based on identity, but then everybody was afraid to talk about everybody else's identity, and so nobody talked about anything.
Yeah.
That was basically it.
Do you think that, like, you could, some writers maybe, when they write about their identity, it can be lazy or gimmicky?
I've done that. Like, any critique I'm making about identity, like, I can make that critique of myself as well, because I've engaged in those things. And so, like, I know from experience that it's not rewarding creatively to fall back onto that.
Yeah. How do you stay away from that? Or do you think it's just that's going to come out at some point?
Yeah. I think you either get sick of it or you don't. Like, eventually you realize it's not, like, satisfying for you. But I think that, and I don't say this in like a mean or judgmental way, but I think there are a couple of different types of people you see in like creative writing. And some of them are really interested in like, yeah, beauty and truth and transcendence and making amazing art. And then other people you see kind of treat it like almost like a game, where it's like they do all of the conferences and all of the apply to all the things and try to get all these various awards, and you see them like striving really hard for these like institutional sort of like benchmarks and checkpoints, and it's like so kind of weird. And I mean, like, again, I don't say that with judgment. Everybody engages with their work differently, but that's like not an instinct that I can relate to.
Is there anyone that wrote about identity that it felt like maybe for a long time you had been dehydrated and like you were drinking water and it was like hydrating you and it felt great to read?
Oh, you know, one of the most life-changing books I've read recently, it was the beginning of last year, I think, I finally read Melissa Broder's Milk Fed. And she writes about like a lot of things, a lot of identity-based things are in the book, but done really well, done in like the way that I feel like it should be, where it's like, yeah, it's just so real and like lived in. And part of one of the identities that's explored is like being a queer woman who is kind of like has at attention with that queerness because of the way that like your family has treated you based on that. And so getting to see that done in like a really honest and like non-identity politics-y way, mm-hmm. like felt really freeing and like rewarding to read. Melissa's like my favorite writer. She's amazing.
Would you ever teach a course on like alt lit?
I think I would. I think I'm ready now. I think there was a time where I was kind of like, again, just because of my relationship to like the literary world or how I felt about it at least, kind of just like wanting to put all of that behind me or whatever. But I think it's been long enough now that, yeah, I would like to explore what that meant, whether through writing about it or, like you said, maybe even teaching a course. Yeah.
What books would be on your syllabus?
Oh my God. You know, I'd have to go back into like my old Facebook and again, my memory holds so much of this. I can think of more that wouldn't be.
Yeah, like what?
No, I'm not gonna say, sorry.
Oh, okay.
but yeah, that's a good question. I'm going to think on that and maybe I'll get back to you and we can talk about like what a course on alt that would look like. Maybe we could even like partner and do some kind of communal like online class.
Yeah, I would definitely bring in Beach Sloth. I think he would be
love Beach Sloth. Oh my God. Yeah. He was one of the early people to like promote my work and was somebody that I like really had admired and looked up to. And like when I saw him like say anything positive about my work or share my, I was like, oh my God, wow. Again, it was another one of those, like, I've made it moments.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt that same way too. And like, it was crazy because he came on the pod. He came like on the podcast and like revealed this face to me. I'm like, oh my God, I feel like I'm like this rarefied moment. Like,
I hope this is okay to say. I hope he won't get mad, but I remember way back when, in the Tumblr days, like 2013, like late at night one time, he like posted a face reveal and then like deleted it really quickly after. But I remembered, like, I got to see it and I felt so special.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy. That's so cool. he considers like coming out and like showing his face, but then he'll like say, oh, maybe he shouldn't. But I don't think he should. He should keep going faceless because he's done it for so long.
I respect it. Yeah, no, I really respect it.
Yeah. Is there anyone else in the communities that like Beach Sloth or anyone or like that like hit like Beach Sloth did?
Oh man, Alexandra Naughton, who is an amazing poet. She put together the first public reading I ever did, and it was at Echo Park Lake in I think 2013. And no. I don't remember everybody who was there, but I remember that being a really big moment too of like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is so cool.
Did you ever meet Catch Business?
You know, I'm not sure. I might have. I did like a lot of readings around that, or started doing a lot more readings around that time, and kind of like I remember meeting all of these people that I knew from like the internet, and it was such a surreal thing that I kind of like, again, it's all kind of a mush and kind of memory hold, so it's possible we met, so I don't want to say no in case I'm wrong.
Did you ever meet Aaron Taylor?
Oh, love Aaron Taylor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We recently I hung out with them at AWP. And I think they've just moved back to LA. So I mean, yeah, I'll probably see them at some point. They're a really good friend and have been really extremely supportive of me, especially over like this last year of upheaval in my life.
Yeah, I think they also just went through something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's been a crazy year for a lot of people.
Yeah. Oops. Did you ever meet, do you know Evil Mountain or that name?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. That takes me back. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you meet them?
Again, I don't want to say no in case they're wrong, but I don't remember.
What about El Nash?
I don't think we ever met. No.
Okay. I was trying to think of anyone else.
Again, yeah, one foot in the door, one foot out of the door person. Yeah. Like, I didn't really like schmooze with any of the main altlit people. I was kind of off to the side. I was briefly on the altlit Wikipedia, and then somebody like erased my name from it after a
what?
A time. Oh, what, yeah. This was like 2014, so it's like water under the bridge. But again, it's that one foot in, one foot out. I prefer it that way.
That's bullshit. God, I don't like that. Oh yeah, okay. Did you ever meet Sarah Jean Alexander?
Ooh, did we ever meet? She like sent me something in the mail that was really beautiful when I think it was when my first book got published. Yeah, no, she's was such a sweetheart. Wow, yeah, we haven't talked in a long time, but I should reach out.
I feel like a lot of people feel that way, that they're like not, because so many people within alt-lit, they won't claim it. They'll like keep their
right. Like how emo used to be back in the day before everybody like reclaimed it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So are you ever, you talking about writing nonfiction, but kind of a memoir is kind of a joke to like sell. Are you ever taking that, would you ever write a novel?
Yeah, I am working on a novel right now, fiction. And I am in like the beginning stages of thinking about a memoir. So that's all I'm comfortable saying about it for now, just because it's like so early on. But yeah, there are things brewing.
I think Alexandra Naughton, she's working on a novel.
Oh, amazing. Okay, cool. Listen, poets have to do it. We have to write a novel or we have to write a memoir. Like, it's unfortunately, we don't have to. I don't actually mean that, but I want to.
If she had a podcast, would you go on it?
Oh, yeah, in a heartbeat.
Okay. I'm trying to get her to bring hers back because she did like two in like 2014 and I found them. And then I'm trying to get her.
I listened to one of them that you had up on your Spotify.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think?
I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. If you had your own podcast, what would it be?
Oh, you know, I've been talking about starting a podcast with my roommate. And I guess, oh God, I hope he doesn't get mad at me for revealing this. But we wanted to, we were joking that we were going to start like a post woke podcast, and we were going to call it The Tranny and the Faggot, because I'm the tranny, he's the faggot. And that's kind of as far as we got.
Yeah. Do you think you'd get backlash for that?
Maybe, but like, no, you don't also give a shit. 2026, no. Like, nobody, like, it's like, where, you know, like, yeah. look around.
Yeah. Like, go, yeah. Have you ever met Jamie Hood?
No, I really love her work, and we're mutuals, but we've never met.
Okay. Yeah. Jamie Hood followed me after you posted something on Substack. What do you think of Substack?
Yeah. I like hated it at first. But it definitely seems like the lesser of the two evils between that and Twitter, AKA X, the everything app.
Yeah. It's terrible. Are you going to do a payment thing?
Maybe eventually. Yeah. I just don't feel like I'm posting consistently enough or like posting things that would be worth somebody paying for, if that makes sense. Yeah.
I think if you do a podcast, you could make that like a payment thing.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Especially, yeah, no, okay. I like that idea.
And then like, so with your poetry, do you set out to write a book, or does it just come after writing so many poems?
Mm. Yeah, definitely the latter. I would say for my most recent book, that one felt maybe a little more like, it wasn't like while I was writing the poems, I was thinking about where will this go in the book, but maybe towards the end, maybe like there were a handful of poems, like the connective tissue poems that I maybe somewhat intentionally gave myself some kind of guide of like, okay, maybe we write towards this or maybe, but most of the time I can't do that. Like I can't say, because I'm not the one who's coming up with it. I'm just like translating it or transmuting it from somewhere else. So I don't feel like I often have a say in that way. And it's like later I have to look at the poems I have and kind of like get a lay of the land and figure out is there a story here? Is there some kind of thematic undercurrent? But also I think the idea of the poetry collection as like a narratively or thematically cohesive thing is like, and I don't know if this is true, I'm just like speaking off the cuff, but it feels like a contemporary, maybe like MFA based thing. Like I feel more drawn to the idea of like, here's just a collection of things I wrote over the past couple of years. If you can find a through line that works for you, find it. But like, I'm not gonna do the work. I know, like I did that with the last book and it felt creatively satisfying to do so because I was trying to kind of get at something like a memoir or something along those lines. And so that felt appropriate. But I think moving forward, I will be thinking more about any books of poetry I release as just like simply a collection.
Mm-hmm. And then you were talking about earlier about forms and finding the class to write forms. Have you ever felt like a need to invoke a Villanelle or a Sestina? Mm. Or when you're writing one of those, did you enjoy it? I guess. I don't know.
Villanelles are hard. Sestinas are really hard. I've written a couple and they're like not very good. I feel like Sestinas are good for when you have like a lot to unpack. Mm-hmm. And obviously you're reusing like the same six words. And so it's like you're circling around something literally. So I think there are occasions where certain forms I think work better than others, but it's also not like a one-to-one thing and you don't always know. So for me, like usually if I'm trying to get a feeling out that I'm having trouble articulating, I'll spontaneously like write a haiku. And it's not like I choose to, it's not like I'm like, oh, I'm going to write a haiku, but it's then I just write three lines and then it's a haiku. Mm-hmm. Because it's doing the thing that the haiku does of like presenting an image. And then there's some kind of like shift in that image, but it's not articulated upon. It's not, explored in that way. We're simply presented with the image and this like shift or change in the image.
And then when you're like do you have a schedule for like when you sit down and write poetry?
Usually no, because it's such a like channeled practice. It's usually coming to me at random times. Like a lot of poems were written while I'd be like sitting in traffic on the freeway and something would spontaneously come to me. So I'd pull out my phone and just start speaking into my voice memos or whatever. And yeah, so it's totally spontaneous still, definitely.
You speak into the phone?
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's a good, where'd you learn that from?
Just necessity. Okay. I was like, I can get this poem out and I don't have any, I'm driving and I can't like write. So I'm just going to like, I think the first time I did it, I opened my camera app and then like recorded a video. And it's just like a video of like my like steering wheel kind of vibrating while I'm like reciting something.
I know, I heard Precious Okimon. I've heard they do that.
I love that. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that just makes sense. I think that poetry is, I just can't imagine ever like intentionally sitting down and being like, I am now going to write a poem about XYZ. Like I feel like I can sometimes tell when a poem was produced that way, and only because I have also done that before and seen mm-hmm. how it like kind of changes the vibe.
Do you think that like that there's less feeling when you're doing that?
I think there's less surprise.
Okay.
Yeah, there's less surprise. There's less room for like that transcendence, I feel like.
Okay.
Like you can tell what somebody is. I think the best poems, you don't know what the poet, it feels like the poet doesn't even know what they're going to say at the end of the line. Like you feel them arriving at it. Whereas when you read like a kind of didactic poem, you can already tell where it's going. And not only can you tell where it's going, you can feel like the poet being able to tell what they already want to say as they're saying it.
Yeah. Do you think like in order to get a transcendence though, that you need a routine or you need to start at some point?
Yeah, I think that it's different for everybody. I would love to have a routine. I would love to have a structured writing schedule. I would love to do yoga at the same time every week. I would love to exercise and eat well. I have a lot of aspirations in life, but we do what we can with the chaos. And so for me, the writing practice is definitely still unpredictable and chaotic. And I think I like it that way for now. But yeah, I'm open to eventually kind of reining it in a little.
Mm-hmm. And when you're reading like a poetry book, do you ever like stop and then go write?
Oh yeah, all the time. I think that, yeah, I'm most inspired to write, whether it be poetry or fiction or nonfiction, after I've just read something. And I think because of that, I'm kind of precious sometimes about how much I read. Like I don't read as much as I'd like to, but it's because I know that whatever I read, it's going to find some way to like inflect what I'm doing.
Do you have any poetry beefs?
I don't hold grudges. I don't believe in grudges. I love and forgive everybody. However, there might be people who don't like me. I'm not going to get too deep into it. I don't believe in like talking shit. And again, like I'm a lover, not a fighter. Mm-hmm. But I think the most recent hilarious, like quote unquote beef to me was back, I think it was in August, there was a Rolling Stone article that was published about like the rising right-wing dissident LA alt community or whatever. Most of which was bullshit. And like half the people they mentioned in the article are not remotely right-wing. Like it was just such a stupid article. But I posted like a joking tweet in response to that article that was like, ooh, wow, you're so dissonant and alternative. Like that was basically the vibe of it. It was like not offensive. I didn't name any names. I didn't like, it was very just like a playful little whatever. And then I had my mentions just filled with these like LA male writers calling me a disgusting man and like all this shit like that. And I was like, you guys are such crybabies. You're triggered over that tweet. It was such an innocuous tweet. And they were just like so beside themselves for like days afterwards because of my one little tweet. So I definitely think there might be some people here in LA who are not big fans of mine, but I don't care. I love them. I forgive them. I'm fine. I don't hold grudges. I have no enemies.
Were there any alt-lit publishers that you did, like Big Lux or anyone else that you really did like, even if you weren't published with them or that you wanted to be published with?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Big Lux was like peak for me, definitely. Just because, again, mm-hmm. it was such a positive experience, and so much of like the bullshit that happens in other with other publishing experiences was like, it was a kind of a breath of fresh air. So yeah, no, I really loved working with Big Lux. But I don't know. I don't really think about, like, I don't base my desire to publish my work based on like a specific press, if that makes sense. I just mm-hmm. like want to get my work out there and be able to express myself in whatever way feels aligned with what I'm doing.
Do you not think about, you don't think about your audience? You just write what you want to write.
Definitely. I used to think about audience a lot more, and it just like got in the way so much. And it's like, you don't even know who your audience really is at the end of the day. Like, you might have some people who reach out, or you might like, yeah, notice certain trends, but at the end of the day, you never know who's going to read your work. And so for me, it's not that I aim towards like the universal, because there's no such thing, maybe, or maybe there is, I don't know. But I just, yeah, I want to write things that like anybody could pick up and get something out of.
In 10 years, where do you see your career or yourself?
oh gosh. I'm like, do I put the vibes out there? Do I manifest, or do I keep it to myself and protect it? No, I'm gonna write a memoir. I'm gonna write a best-selling memoir, and it's gonna be crazy. I've lived an insane life. Anybody who knows even like half the shit I've experienced is like, Jennifer, you need to do something with this. So yeah, I think I'm gonna, in 10 years, I see myself as somebody who's still doing poetry, but who has been able to find some kind of stability via telling her story through other means.
Now, would you do a television show?
I'd sell out. I'd do anything. The poetry is sacred, but in terms of anything else, fuck yeah. Like, I would do a TV show. I'd do a movie, like, whatever.
Do you, are you like someone who practices like quote unquote magic or like witchcraft or anything?
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah, I guess I consider myself like an energy worker, which is like, you know, that's the term of the day, I guess, mm-hmm. or of the moment, but it all kind of means the same thing. I'm somebody who's always felt connected to like things outside of like the physical realm. And not only that, but like I've been able to experience and witness like correlations and associations between the things that I'm feeling or experiencing like outside of the material realm, but then seeing how those things reflect onto like the physical world. And so I've had a lot of experiences throughout my life that I have not been able to ignore, and it's led me to this place where now I consider myself somebody who is somewhat like attuned to certain energies and is able to kind of like process and work with them in certain ways.
What do you think happens after we die?
Easy questions. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. What happens after we die? I would like to believe that our energy just kind of like rejoins like the broader energy of the universe. Like, I think one way to put it is that we become one with God. I like the idea of that. I like the idea of experiencing, yeah, like this like disembodied state of just being pure energy. That sounds really cool. But I also like the idea of reincarnation as well, getting to like live different lives. And I do feel like in a certain way I have lived lives before this one. So I suspect like just on an intuitive level that like existence probably is cyclical.
I think I remember you posting something about religion or God.
Uh-huh.
There is not a controversy, but something that happened.
Yeah, no, definitely. So I, in 2023, I lived in West Virginia for a year. And it was kind of crazy. And it was really, you know, as you can imagine, like not a super easy place to be trans. And I was really like struggling a lot. And I found a lot of solace in this local Presbyterian church that was like super like accepting and affirming. And I sort of healed my relationship with, because I grew up evangelical and wow, totally rejected all of that and was like agnostic for a time, just to like purge all of that out of my system. But then like I still felt in my heart, like, okay, I'm connected to these things that are outside the material world. Like, I'm not an atheist. Like, that's not that doesn't map onto my experience of reality. And so I had to reconcile with that. And I started doing like the kind of magic energy work sort of things. And then when I started attending this Presbyterian church in West Virginia, I found myself like, yeah, kind of coming back into that faith in a way where it's like, I wouldn't call myself like a mainline Christian in the sense that I there's no specific church or denomination that I feel affiliated with, but I feel a strong pull and affiliation towards like a lot of the early Christian mystics and like the Desert Mothers and people like that. And so for me, I think there are a lot of pathways to God or transcendence or whatever you want to call it. But for me particularly, like that lens is kind of nice for me.
What are Desert Mothers?
So they were these women that basically went out to live in the desert and formed these like self-sustaining communities where they'd take care of people and take care of each other while kind of having these mystical experiences of the divine and writing about it and praying. And yeah, they were these really special spaces. Yeah.
Would you ever go out into the desert and write and try to like recreate that?
I've thought about it. Yeah. Especially now that I'm back in Southern California, I really love like the Joshua Tree area. And I've had some really intense, like mystical experiences out there, like completely sober. And so it's definitely a good space to tap into that.
So where were you in West Virginia?
So I was in this town called Shepherdstown. It's a town of 2,000 people approximately. There's a university there, and as far as like West Virginia towns go, it's like pretty like kind of progressive, like not, you know, it's not the stereotypical image that you might have of like a West Virginia holler or something. But it's a small town, and when you leave outside of that perimeter, things kind of change. It's a little different.
Yeah, I think like Scott McClanahan, Julia Scoria, they live out in that region.
Yeah. I really thought, I fell in love with West Virginia while I was there. Despite all the horrible things that I experienced there, I really loved the nature, the energy, the way the air would kind of buzz and the humidity and just like also the community, like seeing the same people every day, saying hi to the same people. Everybody's like their own fixture in town. And there was something really nice about getting to experience that. And also before that, I had basically lived in the same region of Southern California for like 35 years and had never left. And so it was really important for me to like leave and not be living in a place that was superimposed with so many layers of memory and affect. And so just like on an energetic level, it was really cleansing to go elsewhere. So yeah, I loved a lot about West Virginia, and but the few things that were not okay were like so big that I couldn't stay.
Yeah, like what happened?
Well, I didn't have access to hormones. I had to drive. I shouldn't say this on on a podcast. I had to get my meds through other means, and it involved driving many hours every month, and was not easy and was not always there for me. So like there were periods of time where like I didn't have access to my medication, and it was really like distressing to say the least.
That must exist for other people like that, those issues.
Yeah. And there was like maybe one other trans woman in the entire town, because everybody leaves because of that.
Oh shit.
Or they just don't have access, or they have to drive hours and hours and hours, or they have to wait like in a 6 month, 8 month, year long waiting list to see a doctor who has no idea what trans even is.
It's so like backwards. It's so like fucking, there's some parts of this country that are, yeah, even though I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but like, it's fucked up. Have you ever seen a ghost or been visited by a ghost?
Oh yeah. A lot, actually.
A lot? Like when?
A lot. When I was living in Riverside in 2021, I was living in this house that was like subdivided into three apartments, and I was on like the top floor, and I would routinely be visited by like this woman and her son.
What would they do?
Just be really sad and anxious, and I got the sense that they like died in some kind of really like tragic or fucked up way. And so I had this crazy experience. This was around the time when I was starting to finally accept like my connection to whatever. And I had this like crazy experience, like things would fly off the wall. I literally saw things like moving around like poltergeist style. Like there was like a little mini Christmas tree and I literally watched it like lift itself up off a table and fling itself across the room. It was insane. And so I decided to like help these spirits in a way and like help them like cross over. And it was really painful and draining and it took a lot out of me. But then that was kind of how I learned that I could have like an effect, or I could be like a quote unquote energy worker or whatever.
How did you help them move on?
I don't know if I can say, like, it was just being there with the energy and kind of like speaking in a certain way and just kind of like, yeah, it's hard to say. It's, I mean, it's, I kind of don't want to say because I feel very like private about it in some ways, especially because, and again, I don't know, maybe I'm insane. Maybe this wasn't real, but
I'm a little bit freaked out that like the whole room just got real dark while we're talking about this.
Right. Right.
That's fucking weird.
I'm saying, okay, listen, like I've had lots of experiences like this. So I had somebody very close to me pass away in May of 2020. And this woman was basically like a mother to me. I don't have a relationship with my own family. And this woman was like a mother to me for the better part of a decade, and she died and it was horrible. And then the next day, three crows showed up in my backyard and giant, like huge. I've never seen crows up close. I've seen them flying, but like I walked outside and there's one foot in front of me and it's like giant, like it looked like a hawk. And so three of them show up in my backyard. This has never happened before, never happened since. And they hang out by the back door and they won't let me like leave the house. Anytime I go to the back door, they're standing there like screaming and calling at me. And sometimes when I was able to go outside, they would like swoop down kind of at me. And I couldn't tell if they were like mad or what the deal was. And then they'd come over and they'd hang out by the front door and they would just like sit on the porch and just like scream. And then I realized after a certain amount of time that this was this person I had lost, like coming to visit me. And she was trying to like wake me up out of this like pain I'd fallen into. This was again May 2020. We're all stuck inside. I'm like sitting in the house just like losing my mind. And yeah, I feel like her spirit sent these crows to me as like a wake-up call.
No, that's definitely like a thing, like birds, like there's some kind of symbol in some culture or like history or something.
I do feel spiritually connected to birds. Like I always say hi to birds every time I see them. And I feel like we have an understanding.
Can I ask why it got so dark? Like that freaked me the fuck out.
I guess just like a cloud went in front of the sun or like the sun dipped down below something. It's like 5 here in LA. So I think that's probably just getting a little darker.
Just odd that we're talking about spirits and then like it just went fucking dark.
I don't think it's a coincidence.
I don't either. Have you ever seen have you ever had sleep paralysis?
Oh yeah, it used to be a big problem to the point where I was afraid of falling asleep and I had insomnia for a while because I was afraid that I would have that experience.
Yeah, I had it for a while and I would freeze and I'd try to shake my body out of it and I'd be like rocking back and forth and fighting it.
It's so scary and you feel like you can't breathe and it's just like that loss of control. Horrible. How did you get over it?
I don't know. It just somehow stopped happening.
It's resolved. Okay, cool. I'm glad.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a shadow person?
Yeah. Once when I was really sleep deprived, like I had what could have potentially, I don't know if it was like a manic episode or what. We've never fully figured out what's going on with all this. But I had some kind of episode in my early 20s where I didn't sleep for like a couple days and definitely started seeing the shadow people, which could have been a hallucination or it could have been peeking behind the curtain. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. So what other ghostly experiences have you had? Was that it?
Oh yeah. So when I was maybe like 13 or 14, I woke up and there was something standing in my room and it was just like this like dark shroud and it was like speaking in this kind of throaty, like almost like demonic kind of voice. It was really scary and it wouldn't go away. And I just laid there and like pulled my blankets over my head, and I was like so terrified, and I was like, what is happening? And I remember like throwing a shoe at it, and it just like went through and like hit the wall, and it was like the shroud was still there. And it was like, again, just repeating something I couldn't understand in this like garbled kind of like throaty voice. And then after a while of having the blankets over my head, I pulled them down and it was finally gone. And I don't think I slept in my room for a year after that.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't either. What is your interpretation of that?
I think it was some kind of, yeah, negative spirit.
Do you think it was foreshadowing anything?
I think it had to do with, this was my childhood home. And yeah, again, this will all be in the memoir eventually, but I had a crazy fucking childhood. And I think there was just a lot of energy contained in those walls that was like not good. And that was unspoken and unpurged. And I think it manifested. I think that energy can manifest sometimes as like a dark entity.
Do you mind? Do you not want to talk about your childhood?
Oh, I mean, I don't mind. I was kind of joking about saving it for the memoir. Like, but no, essentially, and a lot of this is in the recent poetry collection, although I really have only skimmed the surface, just because it can be hard to write about. But yeah, no, I grew up in like a very like closed off family unit that was like very evangelical, very conservative, and very like punishment based, withholding based, between not having money and being neglected. It was basically like a kind of a feral childhood with like active daily abuse on top of that. But it's the kind of thing that you don't even recognize what's happening when you're a kid because it's all you know. And then you become an adult and you're like, why can't I go to the grocery store without falling down and screaming, you know, whatever it is. Like, and so it's taken me a lot of time to kind of go back and be like, oh wait, that was not normal. Which I think that's an experience a lot of us have as adults. And so through that and through writing about it and, you know, doing therapy and things like that, I've been able to come to a place where I can be slightly okay. But it's interesting that you bring up the topic of family, because right now I'm literally at my sister's apartment pet sitting her dog, and she's the only person in my family who I talk to. And she's amazing. She's wonderful. It's her birthday today. Happy birthday, Bree. But being here like is still, it still like imbues me with like that sense of like, it's hard to be around family, even the ones who are like supportive, because it's always a reminder. And like, for instance, I'm looking right now at a photograph of my sister and my grandfather, who passed away of dementia, and I didn't get to see him like the last 5 years of his life because the other people in my family disowned me, after I came out. And so, yeah, it's just like, there's a heavy energy, whenever I'm around anything that has to do with my family of origin. So it's a lot, but I think I'm finally in the place where I'm ready to write the memoir. I'm ready to really like be real about it.
Is your grandma still around?
I guess so. Yeah, I think she's like living in a retirement community. So I don't really know. Okay. I'm not really interested in like that part of my family anymore. Okay. So I just like don't really affiliate. I will say, So the situation I told you about with my grandfather, I wrote a poem about this and it's on my Instagram, and apparently my grandma found it or saw it somehow like several years later. And she randomly sent me, I had a message in my like message requests folder from my grandma that was like, it just simply read, so many lies about your family. And that was it. And so I just like blocked her and like didn't say anything.
Why does she have an Instagram?
Sorry?
Why does she have an Instagram?
She has no business having an Instagram. Probably just to watch like racist reels like made by AI or something. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I imagine.
Yeah. But they took you in at some point when you were younger?
Yeah, and that's the crazy thing. Like, I had gone through some hard stuff in undergrad. I dropped out. I needed a place to stay, basically. And so I started living in my mom's old bedroom, in her childhood home. and just spending my days, again, sitting in the garage, chain smoking. And so it was this interesting thing because they kind of became my parents during that time. This was like my early 20s. But also because of my grandmother's personality, she was like not a kind person. And so it's like, I had to both be like grateful that I had this place to stay, but also I was treated like a child basically, even though I was an adult. And there were a lot of weird like rules and restrictions. And again, this is like all par for the course in my family. Both sides of my family treat like the family unit like a cult in a way. And there's a lot of like, yeah, narcissistic behavior involved and things like that. I don't like to label people or say that so-and-so is a narcissist, but a lot of narcissistic style behavior guided the logic of how people within my family interacted with one another. And so that was really hard to be around. So I've always had a contentious relationship with my family in general.
Are you feel fearful of them or like coming after you?
I used to be. Yeah, I used to have this like recurring like vision in my head, especially when I first came out, of them all trying to like do like the Britney Spears thing, like try to like get me like have my rights taken away basically by calling me crazy. Like I remember when one of my uncles found my Twitter and realized I had transitioned, he like called my mom and was like, you have to institutionalize your child basically. And so, yeah, I was definitely afraid of like that kind of thing for a while. But now I don't care. Like, I don't care. I have my own life and I'm happy with it.
Hearing this, I can see why you and Aaron Taylor would get along so well. There seems to be similarities.
Definitely. We definitely connected a lot on our families of origin and healing from trying to heal from those things for sure. Yeah. Aaron's been such a great just support and just a wonderful person. Yeah.
What brand of cigarettes did you smoke?
Back then I was Marlboro Reds. These days I was doing like a pack a day. These days I'm smoking like 3 American Spirit Yellows a day.
If you ever come across the red, like, or the smell, does it like violently rip you back there?
You know, nobody smokes in California, so I don't come across that smell very often, but I think the smell of cigarettes in general is very nostalgic for me, and it definitely like activates something in me. Yeah.
Did you ever smoke weed?
Oh yeah, totally.
Okay.
Yeah. Again, I'm in California. Nobody smokes cigarettes, but everybody smokes weed.
And we're back then. How did you get Adderall? You said you snorted it.
Yeah, the person I was with at the time had a prescription, and we would just like kind of party.
Mm-hmm. And you would like they taught you to snort it because yeah.
Yeah, she taught me how to like crush it up, and she'd be like, okay, here we're gonna crush up the blue 10 milligram. Okay, now we're gonna pop open the 30 milligram extended release and crush the little crystals so that they activate immediately. Like she knew everything. It was great.
I've only taken it by mouth. I've never snorted it. I didn't know
the difference. Like that might have been just like an affect thing or like an aesthetic choice, because I feel like it wasn't that different.
I feel like it would just do the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
It acts so fast.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you would write poetry with them? Would they write poetry?
She would sometimes. I tried to like encourage her to write more because I thought she had like interesting things to say. But yeah, no, it was mostly just me writing really crazed long poems.
Did your granddad ever like support you?
Yeah, he was definitely like, when I came out, he was one of the few who wasn't like nasty about it. But by that time, his dementia had already kind of become a thing. And he was basically like in my grandma's hands by that point. So like whatever she said went.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would he have supported, do you think the dementia like made him support you or not or what?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I remember my mom telling me that he would like refer to me as Jennifer and like, yeah, was like totally respectful of that or like saw me that way or whatever it was. So like, I think he was pretty much on board, but also their relationship was such that like my grandma was kind of always in charge, and like what she said went, and especially when he got sick, like, yeah, he was kind of more of like the passive one in that relationship.
Okay. So did you heard from your mom?
Yeah, for a time, in the, like, maybe like a few years ago. I think the last time I saw her was like right after my grandpa passed. But yeah, other than that, like I said, I keep in touch with my sister, who's wonderful.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful to have her.
What are you going to get her for her birthday?
Well, I took her out to dinner the other night, and I got her a candle and some flowers, but since I'm currently fun employed, I've promised her something a little more special when some money comes my way, because I'd really like to. She got me this locket, actually, for my birthday, which was a month ago, and that was so special to me. So I really want to get her something special soon.
When was your birthday?
December 17th.
Okay, mine was January 4th.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday to you, too.
Thank you.
What's
the sign for January 4th?
Capricorn.
Capricorn. Okay. Oh, that's right. Sagittarius, Capricorn, and then Aquarius, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Capricorn's a great sign.
Are you into that? Like astrology and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, like as much as any 38-year-old woman these days is, I guess.
How do you feel about the big one coming up? It kind of freaks me out.
You know, I don't actually, you know more about me apparently, or more about it than me apparently, because I'm not sure what the big one.
What's the big 40.
Oh, I thought you were talking about something astrological. Sorry.
Oh, no.
The big 40. Yeah. Oh my God. I can't believe I just age doxed myself.
Well, I'm 37. So.
Well, enjoy it. 37 is a good year. Yeah. How am I feeling about 40? If you had asked me like a year ago, I would probably have a different response, but I embrace it. I'm looking forward to it. I'm like so ready to be 40.
Yeah. I think having the Shabby Doll House community and like all those artists, and they're all aging with me, it feels, mm-hmm. It eases it a little bit. Yeah. And they all have to go through it too. So
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You can look around and be like, okay, they survived. They're doing okay. I can do this.
Yeah. So it's been about 90 minutes. Is there anything you would like me to still ask?
Oh gosh, that's such a nice question. Nobody's ever asked me if there's anything that I'd like them to ask me. That's so funny. No, I can't think of anything specific, but this has been so nice. It's been really cool to get to talk about these things and kind of like, yeah, go back in my mind into the past and think about, yeah, how we got here. It's interesting. I really enjoyed your questions, and yeah, I just feel like your style of conversation was really fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like extreme ADHD, so
same.
Yeah. What's last one? What are you like, Spotify? What song do you go to?
Ooh, such a good question. And this changes constantly. I'm gonna pull it up right now just to see what's in my, I just made like a new playlist recently. Actually, I made a playlist that was kind of based on one of the poems that you published, the vibing poem. And I've been listening, one of the songs on that playlist that I've been listening to on repeat a lot is Honeymoon by Lana Del Rey, which is just like, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on. It's been awesome.
Thank you so much.
No problem. Bye. See you. Bye.
See ya.
See ya. That was Jennifer Espinosa. That was awesome. That was a great conversation. Yeah, slow fi lit. Thank you all for tuning in, and I'll see you guys next time.